The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Coming soon from Graphic Audio. Higbee, Colorado, population 147, is about to become a boomtown. The visionary General Wade Garrison is building a railroad to connect Higbee to the Santa Fe Rail. But a rancher named Ike Clinton has his own selfish reasons for making sure these bands of steel go nowhere, and he'll go to any lengths to derail Garrison's plans.
Whoa, whoa, Rhoda! Hey, you some kind of fool falling a tree across the road like that? Don't you know that could kill someone? Now how are we supposed to get through here?
You ain't.
Hey, I know you. You're one of the Clintons, ain't you?
They call me Clintus.
Ah! Mr. True!
The third driver jumped off his wagon and took off running.
The third driver is getting away, Clintus.
No, he ain't. Let's burn them wagons and get the hell out of here.
Falcon McAllister owes a wartime debt to the general and answers the call to aid the man in his fight with the Clinton brood. The proud little town of Higbee is about to be torn to pieces. Neighbors, families, and lovers will be bitterly divided, and bodies will litter the streets. And before the last gun smoke clears, Falcon will come face to face with the Clintons' hired gunman, an outlaw known as the fastest gun in the West, Jefferson Tyree.
Is he here?
Yes. That's him, Travis. Standing next to Clintus. Tyree is the fellow with the gray shirt.
Thanks. Step back out of the way.
Jefferson Tyree, turn around.
Travis!
Denham ran to the collapsed form of his friend. Tyree stood for a long moment, holding the still smoking pistol.
Is he dead?
Yes, he's dead. You murdered him!
You might have noticed. He already had the gun in his hand when he braced me.
He didn't brace you, Tyree. He was attempting to arrest you.
Arrest me, huh? Well, maybe he should have said something. I thought he was just somebody trying to build a reputation by killing Jefferson Tyree.
One doesn't build a reputation by killing polecats or rattlesnakes. And compared to you, the polecat and the rattlesnake are some of God's noblest creatures.
You have a big mouth, don't you, friend? This fella always have a way with words like that, Clintus.
Oh, yeah. This is Harold Denham, publisher of our local newspaper.
The local newspaper, huh? So are you going to write about this, Mr. Newspaper Man?
Oh, I am indeed. If you think you can frighten away the press, you have another thing coming.
Oh, I don't want to frighten you away. I want you to print the story. Just as it happened. And I want you to say that when this fella braced me, he was already holding a pistol in his hand. But that I was so quick that I turned, drew, and shot him before he could shoot me.
I will not make anything heroic out of this.
I ain't asking you to make me a hero, newspaper boy. I'm just asking you to tell the truth.
Falcon knows that the fastest way to the end of a tragedy is straight through the blood and tears, behind the flash of a blazing gun.
You boys ready? Bring them on.
Don't miss the new adventures of Falcon McAllister in Eagles 13, Thunder of Eagles. There were several names in the West that caused brave men to sit down and shut up. Smoke Jensen, Falcon McAllister, Louis Longmont, and Frank Morgan.
Enough talk, old man! Grab iron!
You want a shooting, boy? You're gonna have to start it.
You think I won't?
I hope you don't, kid.
You're gonna die, Morgan!
We all die, kid. Some long before their time.
I thought all them stories about you was just talk?
I wish it was.
Once, Frank Morgan had a wife and a future on the land. Now Morgan's taken up the one skill that always came easy, gunfighting. And with nothing left to lose, he's the last man who will ever back down.
Who the hell are you?
Frank Morgan.
Oh, hell.
From the creators that brought you the critically acclaimed Eagles series and the first Mountain Man, there's a new sheriff in town, and he's tougher than rawhide and as quick as a striking rattler. Frank Morgan is the last gunfighter. William W. Johnstone's epic new western, now in graphic audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The First Mountain Man 10, Preacher's Justice. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Nanette Savard, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Karen Carbone, Thomas Penny, Tim Carlin, James Konacek, Dylan Lynch, M.B. Van Dorn, Andy Clements, James Lewis, Kate Torrey, Michael Glenn, Johann Detweiler, Dan Smith, Eric Messner, Peter Stray, and Lily Beacon. The sky over the Rocky Mountains was a brilliant crystalline blue. Though it was cloudless now, it had snowed steadily for the previous 24 hours, and the deep pack on the ground was painfully bright under the relentless sun. It also made traveling difficult, so the man everyone called Preacher had not even attempted to ride his horse this morning. Instead, the mountain man and fur trapper had taken a pack mule with him, and he led the animal, laboriously breaking a path through the nearly waist-deep snow. The mule was carrying a string of beaver traps that over the previous several days had been carefully inspected. Repairs had been made as necessary. The Preacher, who was 27 years old, had been trapping in these mountains since he was 14. He had a dark shock of hair that he kept trimmed with a sharp knife. Though it was sometimes difficult to do so, he also managed to shave at least two or three times a week, so that while he often had stubble, he never had a beard. His eyes were dark. From a distance, one might think they were brown, but upon closer examination, they proved to be a deep cobalt blue. He was a little taller than average, and slender of build, but with broad shoulders and muscular arms, powerful legs, strengthened by his years of trapping in the mountains. Preacher looked toward a distinctive peak and saw feathery tendrils of snow streaming out from it in the cold, piercing wind of the higher climbs. Snow crystals glistened in the sun and formed a prison of color to crown the beauty of the rugged mountains and dark green trees. From that peak, which Preacher called Eagle's Beak, the young mountain man got his bearings. Thus oriented, he started up a narrow draw until he found the creek he was looking for. Preacher ground-hobbled his mule, took some of the traps, and stepped out into the stream, breaking through the thin ice that had formed at the stream's edge. The nearly paralyzing cold shot up his legs as he waded into the water, looking for the best place to put his traps. It would have been easier and less painful to move along the shoreline, but he'd learned long ago to use the water as a means of masking his scent from the beaver.
Finally, he came to the place he had discovered 5 years earlier, a place rich with beaver that had so far been undiscovered by the other trappers. Since his discovery, he had worked this area as if it were his own private reserve. While there was no such thing as privately owned land here, the trappers recognized and followed a code of the right of territory according to who came first. Dropping all those traps in the water, the preacher began setting them by depressing the springs by standing on them, putting 1 foot on each trap arm to open it up. When the trap was open, he engaged the pan notch, holding it in a set position. As each trap was set, he would extend the trap chain to its fullest length out toward the deeper water, where a trap stake was passed through the ring at the end of the chain and driven into the stream bed. Finally, he placed the bait. The bait was a wand of willow, cut to a length that would permit its small end to extend from the stream bank directly over the pan of the trap. Bark was scraped from the stick and castoreum was smeared on the end of the switch, so that it hung about 6 inches or more above the trap. Castoreum was an oil taken from the glands of a beaver. Once his traps were set, Preacher returned to the tiny cabin he would call home while wintering in the mountains. It was no secret that Preacher had hit upon a mother load of beaver. Every year his catch was consistently the highest, or very near the highest, taken. While others might have envied him his good luck, they were bound by the code they all followed not to horn in on him. But there was one trapper who wasn't bound by this, or any other code, and he was determined to find Preacher's secret location. He didn't know where Preacher trapped, but he did know where he lived. He had made camp near Preacher's cabin, surviving the storm just past in order to follow him to his secret place. The recent snow made it easy to follow because he didn't even have to stay in contact with Preacher. All he had to do was follow the path left by Preacher and his mule through the snow.
It'll be like taking a sugar tit from a baby.
His traps set, Preacher returned to his little cabin. This was his 7th year in this same location, and over the years he had made several modifications to improve the living conditions. The thick log walls were well chinked with mud and insulated with moss, so that even the coldest Arctic blasts were kept at bay. Initially, the cabin had been heated with a fireplace, but a few years ago he'd bought an iron stove at Rendezvous and hauled it back on one of his pack mules. The stove was a marvel of efficiency, heating the cabin much better and with considerably less wood than was consumed by the fireplace. It also made it easier to cook his meals, because he could set a pot right on top of the stove, rather than moving it from place to place within the fireplace. Preacher had become a pretty good cook over the years of living alone. When he returned home after setting the traps, he was greeted with the enticing aroma of a simmering beaver tail stew. He rolled out some biscuits and put them on to bake. Automatically, he made an extra biscuit for Dog. Then he remembered that Dog wasn't with him. Last year, concerned for the safety of Jenny, he left Dog with her, charging the animal with the responsibility of looking out for the woman that came closer to being Preacher's woman than any other. Thus it was that when Preacher returned to the mountains, Dog went with Jenny to St. Louis. Clearly, Dog would have preferred to come back with Preacher. It showed in his eyes as Preacher took his leave. But Preacher had made it personal, asking Dog as a favor to him to stay and watch after Jenny. Dog accepted the responsibility without complaint.
I'll miss you, Dog. I can get along without people just fine. Truth to tell, I prefer it without people. But I do wish I had you around to keep me company.
When the biscuits were done, Preacher took a couple of them, spooned up a generous serving of the stew, and sat at the crude table he had made to enjoy his dinner. As Preacher ate his meal, he went through the figures in his little ledger book. If he had as good a year this year as he did last, and he had no reason to suspect that he wouldn't, he would be able to add substantially to his bank account. By the standards of the day, Preacher could almost count himself a rich man. He was worth just under $15,000, and would go over that amount by the end of the season. Funny thing was, money meant nothing to him except as a means of keeping score. What with what he had now, he could buy the finest house in St. Louis and live in luxury for many years.
Sometimes he felt guilty for not doing that. He could marry Jenny and make a good life for her and for himself. But even the thought of such a thing was difficult to consider. He looked up from his ledger and peeked through the window, made of real glass that he'd packed in 3 years ago, at the ruggedly beautiful terrain surrounding his cabin.
I'm sorry, Jenny, old girl. To the degree that I can understand love between a man and a woman, I probably do love you. But if I gave all this up, I'd have such a hunger for it in my heart that there wouldn't be anything left for you. I hope you understand.
When Preacher returned to check out his traps a few days later, he was surprised to see that they had all been removed, set aside, and replaced by another man's traps.
Son of a bitch!
Angrily, he removed the new traps and put his own back in place. The process took most of the day. It was one thing to crowd in on another man's territory. Now, that was done from time to time, and it nearly always brought about harsh feelings. But to actually remove another man's traps was an affront of the worst goddamn kind. Preacher considered breaking the offending traps, but finally decided against it. Instead, he left one of them on the bank of the stream and placed rocks on the ground in the form of an arrow, pointing towards his cabin, indicating that if the man wanted to retrieve his traps, he would damn well have to come see Preacher to get them. When Preacher returned to his cabin, he hung the poacher's traps up on the outside wall, in plain view of anyone who might happen by. Exactly 1 week later, Preacher was tending to his mules when he saw a lone figure trekking across the snow-covered meadows that separated Preacher's cabin from the woods. The man was wearing a buffalo robe and a fur cap, and as he crossed the meadows, he left a long, dark smear in the pristine white snow behind him. No doubt, this was the one who had attempted to poach on Preacher's territory. Preacher had left his weapons inside. However, there was a hatchet nearby. Preacher felt a sense of security in believing that if need be, he could arm himself quickly. Before the man was halfway across the meadow, Preacher recognized him as Henri Mouchette. He wasn't surprised that this was the man who had so blatantly violated the trapper's code. Mouchette had the reputation of being someone who was very hard to get along with. He was even suspected of stealing from other traps, though as no one had ever actually caught him doing it, the accusation had never been brought before the trapper's court.
Hello, Mouchette. What brings you by?
Mouchette stopped a few feet away from Preacher.
You son of a bitch! You stole my traps!
Oh, I haven't stolen them, Mouchette. As you can see, they're hanging right here on the cabin in clear sight.
They're here now. But you took them from my stream.
Oh, yes siree, I did that all right. As a matter of fact, I took them right after you took mine.
That is my place.
And what makes you think that it's your place, seeing as I was there first?
I've been trapping that stream for years. Hell, I was trapping it when you were a pup.
You know as well as I do that the first person to arrive at a stream has the right to put out his own traps. I didn't see any traps here when I arrived.
I laid off a couple of years because I didn't want the stream to be over-trapped. I quit trapping so it could recover. Then, when I went back to it, I seen your traps there. I didn't figure that would be right, so I took them out.
You saying you were trapping there 2 years ago?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. 2 years ago, I trapped the stream. Then I let it be for 2 years.
Well, now that's where the mistake is, you see, because you must have your streams mixed up. I've been trapping this same stream for 5 years now, so you couldn't have been here 2 years ago.
I ain't the one that made the mistake. It was you. By all that's right, that stream belongs to me.
Not now, Dudden. Put your trap somewhere else.
I aim to put my traps right back where I had them. And I plan to get your traps out of there.
Well now, Mr. Mouchette, I would strongly advise you against doing that. Mouchette glared at Preacher for a long moment. Then, without another word, he took his traps and trekked back into the woods, once more leaving his footprints in the snow behind him. Preacher noted, with some satisfaction, that he wasn't heading toward the stream in question. Preacher waited 4 days before he returned to the stream. Evidently, Mouchette had paid heed to Preacher's warning, because Preacher's traps were still in place. It was nearly 3 weeks after his encounter with Mouchette. Preacher was gathering his first crop of beaver pelt. The traps were full, and beaver were prime with rich coats. Preacher dove to the ground, burrowed into the snow, and turned to look in the direction from which the shot had come. Just below a snow-barren pine bough, he saw a puff of smoke hanging in the cold, still air. Wriggling through the snow on his belly, Preacher returned to his kit. Grabbing his rifle, he rolled onto his back and began loading it. Preacher saw a rifle barrel protrude from the trees, not where the smoke of the first shot was, but from some distance away. His assailant had cleverly changed positions after the first shot. Preacher rolled hard to the right.
Now, you son of a bitch! You're empty and I'm loaded!
Standing, Preacher moved quickly toward the puff of smoke. The Preacher had miscalculated, because another barrel suddenly appeared. Not a rifle, but a pistol. The Preacher hit the ground this time. He felt himself tumbling, slipping, and sliding down the side of a long hill. When he finally stopped, he was more than 100 feet below where he had started. Scrambling back to his feet, Preacher searched through the snow until he found his rifle. Cleaning the flint and pan of snow, he worked his way back up the hill. When he got to the top, he started toward the tree line where he had last seen his assailant. He found marks in the snow where the man had waited in ambush for him, but whoever it was had gone. Following the trail the assailant left, Preacher saw someone hurrying across an open field, trying to reach the safety of the woods on the other side. He was too far away for Preacher to be certain. There was something about the way the man was moving that made Preacher believe it was Mouchette. And of course, as he thought about it, Mouchette was the only one who would have a motive to attack him. Preacher raised the rifle to his shoulder and aimed. Preacher took his finger off the trigger and lowered the rifle. Whoever it was had tried to kill him, and he had every right to shoot. The Preacher's life wasn't in immediate danger right now. Shoot a man in the back while he was fleeing didn't set well with Preacher, even though that man had tried to kill him. Raising the rifle to his shoulder again, he aimed, not to kill, but to frighten. Preacher saw the strike of the ball in the snow just a few feet in front of the fleeing man. The fleeing man threw himself to the ground in terror.
Let that be a lesson to you, Mouchette. You come back, don't think you're gonna get another shot at me.
Returning to work his trap line, Preacher leaned the rifle against a tree, then loaded his pistol and put it on the ground close by. Keeping both firearms loaded and ready, he went back to work.
Damn, dog, this is one time I could have really used you. You never let anyone sneak up on me like that.
Dog lay on the front porch of the little St. Louis store into which Jenny had gone. There were some buildings he could go into, and some that he couldn't. Dog never understood exactly why it was like that, but he was aware of the difference, and he knew that this was one of those buildings where he was not welcome. Being denied entry into a building didn't present a problem to Dog. Whenever he encountered a building in which he wasn't welcome, he'd simply wait outside until Jenny came out again. He didn't care that much about being around humans anyway. Dog missed the life he had led before coming to this place. Part wolf, he was completely at home in the woods and the mountains. But he was part dog as well, and the part of him that was dog felt some instinct to bond with man. The man Dog chose was well worthy of his bonding, for Dog had seen the man fight a bear and kill it. Others called that man Preacher, but Dog, well, Dog thought of him as Bear Killer. Dog not only bonded with Bear Killer, but he traveled with him as well. In their travels, they wound up here, in this place of many men and few animals. Dog had waited patiently for Bear Killer to leave this place of many men and few animals so he could return to the woods and the mountains. Before it was time to leave, however, Bear Killer gave Dog a job to do. That job was to look after Bear Killer's woman. Dog wanted to leave with Bear Killer, but the part of him that was a dog would not let him do so. Loyalty was the strongest trait of a dog, and Dog's loyalty was particularly well developed. Others came and left the little store, but Bear Killer's woman, Jenny, was still inside. So Dog slept on the porch with his nose between his paws. As he slept, he dreamed of the woods and the mountains, the clear, sweet streams of water, and the rabbits he would chase down and eat. Yet even as he was dreaming, part of him was still alert. He assessed all who entered or left the store to determine whether or not they represented any danger to the woman he had been ordered to protect. Some would speak to him, others would go out of their way to avoid him, frightened by his powerful wolf-like appearance. Dog actually preferred those who went out of their way to avoid him.
There you are, Dog, right where I left you.
Jenny squatted down beside him and smiled at him. Jenny was an exceptionally pretty woman, with a smooth olive complexion skin, high cheekbones, flashing brown eyes, and dark hair that hung in easy curls about her shoulders. She held a piece of ribbon beside her face.
Do you think this is pretty?
Dog raised his head and twisted it slightly as if he was trying to respond to her question.
Of course you think it's pretty. You're a good dog, and you like anything I like. Come, let's go.
Theodore Ipson sat across the desk from Joel Fontaine, president of the Trust Bank of Philadelphia. They were in Fontaine's office, and as a measure of the size of the Trust Bank, Fontaine's office alone was as large as the entire riverbank of St. Louis, the bank where Ipson had worked before coming to Philadelphia.
Mr. Ipson, I have recently come in receipt of a very disturbing letter.
A disturbing letter, sir? What type of letter?
It is a letter from one William Ashley of St. Louis. I'm sure you are familiar with William Ashley, are you not?
Yes, sir, indeed. I do know Mr. Ashley.
Ipson knew that whatever Ashley had to say in the letter about him couldn't be good.
Mr. Ashley is a furrier. And as such, he is a man who must deal with the most common class of people. Unfortunately, I'm afraid he is sometimes unduly swayed by them.
Unduly swayed by them?
Prone to believe them over the more substantial and trustworthy citizens of the community.
Yeah, an interesting observation.
I would be interested in hearing what Mr. Ashley has to say. What is the subject of the letter, if you don't mind sharing?
Oh, I don't mind sharing at all, as it concerns you.
The letter concerns me? How so?
According to William Ashley, there was an incident in St. Louis where mortgage money duly paid to the Riverbank of St. Louis was not credited.
Well, now, I don't understand that. Why would Mr. Ashley be writing to you about some business that supposedly took place in St. Louis? It would seem to me that he would take that up with the Riverbank. And as I am no longer with the Riverbank, why would that information, if it is true, concern me?
Well, it has to do with you, Mr. Ipson. Because I'm afraid Mr. Ashley is accusing you of fraud.
Me? Oh, that's preposterous. I have no idea what he's even talking about. My record at the Riverbank of St. Louis is spotless. Why, you checked my credentials yourself. You were satisfied that they were impeccable. The directors of the Riverbank in St. Louis gave me a sterling report. I know that they did.
That is true.
Well, then, there you go. If the bank has found no fault with me, then this preposterous story that Mr. Ashley is spreading about me taking money from some whore and not crediting her account has absolutely no basis in fact.
Whore? And just what whore would that be, Mr. Ipson?
The woman you said is claiming that I stole money from her. Why, she is nothing but a common whore. As a matter of fact, the house on which we held her mortgage was a house of prostitution.
Well, now, that is interesting. For as it turns out, the money in question was supposed to be paid on a woman's house. But I made no mention of that fact. If, as you say, you have no idea what I'm talking about, how is it that you know that I was talking about a woman?
I just know because both she and Mr. Ashley have tried to make trouble for me in the past. And I'm sure, should you deem it necessary to look into this most preposterous story any further, you will see that I am telling the truth.
Yes, I'm sure that the investigation will prove you innocent. Although I must say, the amount of money Mr. Ashley claims was not credited to the woman, $950, is remarkably close to the amount of money you deposited in your personal account when you arrived at our bank. The amount you deposited was $900, I believe.
Yes, but of course, that was a mere coincidence. I assure you, there's nothing to this story. You will recall that when I came to work here, I told you that I had been instrumental in putting some brothel houses out of business.
Oh, yes, I do recall.
I'm sure this all has to do with that. It is spite, directed against me because I did my civic duty. As I say, the woman in question is a whore. You ask how I know who was behind this, even though you had not mentioned a name. I can only report that the woman in question has tried shenanigans of this sort before. It is bitterness, pure and simple.
Well, that may be the case for the woman, but what about Mr. Ashley? I've checked on him, and I find that he is one of the most successful businessmen in St. Louis, highly respected by all in the fur trading industry.
Yes, but you must understand that William Ashley cavorts on a daily basis with whores, trappers, hunters, wilderness guides, boatmen, and one cannot come into such constant contact with such people without being affected by them. Why, I have no doubt that Mr. William Ashley was himself a habitué of the establishment in question.
That is quite an accusation.
Perhaps so, but it is less damning than the false accusation he has lodged against me.
Why do you think someone like Ashley would make such a charge?
Oh, that's easy to understand. The whore, Jenny, no doubt talked him into making the accusation against me and bringing it to your attention. I'm sure that she understands that a respectable bank such as the Trust Bank of Philadelphia will have nothing to do with such a spurious accusation being lodged against a bank officer by a common whore.
Well, no doubt the matter will soon be cleared up.
Yes, I'm sure it will be.
Go on back to work, Mr. Epson. I will investigate thoroughly, but quietly.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I shall return to work confident in my total and complete exculpation.
Shortly after he left Fontaine's office, Epson wrote a letter to a St. Louis citizen whom he knew to be of a disreputable character. Such a low-class citizen, however, was exactly what he needed for the task at hand. 20 days after Epson mailed the letter, the St. Louis postal clerk stepped into LaBarge's saloon carrying the letter with him. LaBarge, who was wiping off the bar, looked up as Toomey came inside. He smiled.
Well, well, if it isn't our illustrious mail official, Mr. Toomey, this is indeed an occasion. I don't believe I've ever seen you in here before. What can I get for you, Mr. Toomey?
I'm not here to partake of any spirits, thank you. I am here on U.S. government business. I have come to deliver a letter.
I got a letter? Who from?
It isn't for you.
Well, if the letter ain't from me, what the hell are you doing in my tavern?
Because I am told that the person for whom I am looking can nearly always be found here. And, indeed, there he is.
When LaBarge looked in the same direction as Toomey, he blinked in surprise.
What the hell? Surely you ain't talking about Ben Cavanaugh's.
I am.
Well, hell, that son of a bitch can barely read.
My dear Mr. LaBarge, whether or not any of the recipients of our mail can read is of no concern to the U.S. Post Office. Our job is merely to see that the recipient receives the letter that is sent to him. Getting it read is his responsibility.
At one time, Ben Cavanaugh considered himself a fur trapper, and he had actually spent a few winters in the mountains. But he had never been very productive in what was actually a very difficult job. Then, when his friend Percy McDill got himself killed by the one they called Preacher, Cavanaugh gave up the trade altogether. Now, Cavanaugh made his living by pulling odd jobs when they were available, and by resorting to petty thievery when necessary. It worked well that way, because Cavanaugh's personal needs were few. He never wasted money on clothes or personal hygiene. He lived in an empty stall at the livery, paying for it by mucking out stables. And there were a handful of houses in town where the woman of the house felt disposed toward feeding the hungry and clothing the naked, so he could show up at the back door of such a place, hat in hand, and be able to count on a meal. With those basic needs met, any money Cavanaugh managed to earn through the various odd jobs he performed was spent in LaBarge's tavern. As a result, Cavanaugh spent every available hour there, often the first to arrive when LaBarge opened his doors in the morning, certainly the last one to leave in the evening. Cavanis was there now, at a table in the back of the room, drinking raw whiskey and talking to a few others whose own station in life was no higher than his. He had no idea an official of the U.S. Post Office was looking for him to deliver a letter. Hell, he'd never gotten a letter in his entire life.
Would you be Ben Cavanis?
Who's asking?
I am an official of the U.S. Post Office, and I have a letter for Mr. Ben Cavanis.
You have a letter for me?
I do indeed.
Toomey passed the letter to Cavanis.
Ha! Who do you know that can actually write, let alone send you a letter?
Cavanis looked at the man named Slater, who, like Cavanis, lived a hand-to-mouth existence, working as much for liquor as for food.
You'd be surprised at the high-tone people I know.
Cavanis opened the envelope and took out two pieces of paper. One piece of paper was obviously a letter to him, while the other looked official. He'd never seen anything quite like it.
What is this here thing?
Toomey looked at the paper.
That's a bank draft for $15.
What does that mean? What's a bank draft?
That means you can take it to the bank and they will give you $15.
The hell you say? They'll just give it to me for nothing?
No, not for nothing. You will have to present them with this draft. See, it's made out to you.
I'll be damned. Who'll give me $15?
I suppose if you read the letter, you will find the answer to your question.
Yeah, I'll read the letter.
Cavanis began to read, and even though he was reading silently, his lips formed every word.
What does the letter say, Cavanis?
Cavanis looked up from the letter and put his hand over the words.
This here's my letter, and it ain't none of your business what it says.
It was dark. Jenny and Dog were walking home. For many years, Jenny had made her living as a prostitute, but it wasn't a profession she chose. Born to a half-black mother in a whorehouse in New Orleans, Jenny had been sold into slavery as a very young girl. The man who bought her, Lucas Younger, had intended to make her into a housemaid. However, as she was a very beautiful young girl, he realized early that if he played his cards right, she could be worth a whole lot of money to him. When she was but 13, he paraded her in front of a collection of the finest and wealthiest gentlemen of New Orleans. The price one man paid for the privilege of being first more than compensated Younger for her purchase in the first place. He managed to get away with selling her for the first time for almost 6 months, until word got out as to what he was doing, and he was forced to flee New Orleans, taking Jenny with him. Going by wagon from New Orleans to St. Louis, he made Jenny available for all who would pay. In those early days, Jenny would sometimes service as many as 20 or 25 men in one night, all arranged by Lucas Younger. It was during that trip north that she met Preacher for the first time. As a 12-year-old boy, experimenting with beer for the first time, he was easy pickings for Younger, who knocked him out, put him on his wagon, and took him with him. Preacher was called Art then, and Jenny was a full year older than he was. A few years later, their paths crossed a second time. Jenny, now the slave of another man, was still being forced to earn her keep by prostitution. At this meeting, Art managed to win Jenny in a shooting contest. The thought of being his slave actually pleased Jenny, but Art would have none of it. He gave Jenny her papers of manumission, freeing her forever. In turn, Jenny provided the boy, who was not yet known as Preacher, with his, passage into manhood. Even though Jenny was free, she was a person with a checkered past, unable to earn a living in any way except the only way she knew. Once more, she became a prostitute. But this time, working for herself, she was at least able to profit from it. Because she was frugal, she soon earned enough money to start her own brothel, which she staffed with a full complement of girls, carefully chosen for their looks and demeanor. The House of Flowers, as she called her brothel, quickly became the most successful operation of its kind in St. Louis, and its parlors hosted some of the most influential men in the city and state. But it also became a lightning rod for civic action groups, especially the Women's Auxiliary of the St. Louis Betterment League, whose president was Sybil Abernathy, wife of the president of the Board of Directors of the River Bank of St. Louis. Once Jenny had her business going, she left the line, as it was called when one was an active prostitute, doing nothing but administering her house. From that time on, the only time she was ever with a man was on those rare times when Preacher would come to St. Louis. Jenny was in love with Preacher. She never spoke about this to him because she knew that it wouldn't work out. Preacher would never be happy in the city, and she could not live in the isolation of the mountains. As a result, Preacher's visits to St. Louis were all the sweeter because they provided little windows on a life that she could only glimpse but would never have. When Jenny learned that Sybil Abernathy intended to force her husband to call in the loan, she took $475 from her savings and presented it to the chief teller at the bank. It was enough money to pay off the mortgage on her house, thus making it fully hers, safe from the machinations of Sybil Abernathy. What Jenny didn't realize was that Preacher had also paid off her mortgage, doing so quietly because he was afraid Jenny wouldn't take the money from him. In neither case, however, was the money credited. Jenny wound up losing her house. These days, Jenny shared a small house with her best friend, Carla. Carla, who was a few years younger than Jenny, had lived in the House of Flowers with Jenny and the other girls. Although Carla lived there, she was not and had never been one of the prostitutes. By living together, the two women were not only company for each other, they also shared living expenses. Carla earned her money by working in a cafe, whereas Jenny earned her income by working as a seamstress now. Jenny was a very good seamstress, but she had to struggle for a living. Many of the women in town, aware of her past, would have nothing to do with her. And one of the most vocal women against her was the one most opposed to her while she was running the whorehouse, Sybil Abernathy. Ironically, it was Mrs. Abernathy's house Jenny was coming from tonight. Though it killed Mrs. Abernathy's soul to have to work with Jenny, the bank president's wife was in a bind. She had been invited to a party at the governor's mansion in Jefferson City, and she had nothing to wear. The only way she could get ready in time was to use Jenny's services. She decided to do so, but insisted that Jenny make her visits for fittings only at night. In doing so, Sybil thought it would lessen the chances that Jenny would be seen coming to or from her house. Mrs. Abernathy was a very exacting client, and if Jenny hadn't needed the money, she would have told her to get someone else to make her own damn gown. But she did need the money, so she put up with Sybil's demands, redoing the seams, making adjustments here and changes there. It was nearly midnight by the time she left for home. Although Mrs. Abernathy had thought she was hiring Jenny in secret, such a piece of gossip was just too juicy to keep. The news didn't come from Jenny, because she had told no one. Her sense of integrity extended even to someone like Mrs. Abernathy. But others were aware of the arrangement, and soon the entire town knew that Jenny was making a special gown for Sybil Abernathy to wear to the governor's ball. One of those who knew was Ben Cavanis. He also knew that Mrs. Abernathy had demanded that Jenny work for her only at night. Armed with that information, Cavanis waited in an alley along the route between Mrs. Abernathy's mansion and the small house that Jenny shared with Carla. As he waited, he reached down to grab hold of himself. The letter had been very specific as to what he had to do to earn the $15 the bank draft represented, and it was gonna be fun. Unlike some of the larger cities back east, St. Louis had only a few street lamps, and they were in the middle of town. In the part of the city that was closest to Jenny's house, the streets were narrow and shadowed. It was a particularly dark night, for there was no moon out. Had Dog not been with her, Jenny would have been too frightened to be outside. Dog sensed the man before he smelled him, and he smelled him before he heard anything suspicious. As they approached the alley, Dog stopped. The hackles stood up on the back of his neck.
What is it, Dog?
There was someone in the alley ahead, someone waiting for him. Dog didn't know who it was, but he knew that whoever it was, he was up to no good. Dog lowered his head slightly and moved ahead slowly and deliberately. Suddenly, a man jumped out of the alley in front of him.
Good evening, Missy.
I know who you are. You're Ben Cavanis. How dare you jump out at me? What do you mean by frightening me like this?
Missy, you're causing a lot of trouble for a very important man, and he don't like it none.
What are you talking about?
Mr. Epson don't want no more letters being wrote about him.
I don't care what he wants. I will continue writing letters about him until I get my money back.
Then I reckon I'm gonna have to change your mind.
Until now, Dog had merely been watching Cavanaugh. The moment Cavanaugh started forward, though, Dog leapt forward himself, nipping him on the leg.
What the hell? Call that dog off! Call him off!
I expect you'd better get out of here.
Dog wouldn't attack again unless the man attacked Jenny. But if need be, he was in position to do so.
No! No! Call him off! Call him off!
Get out of here, and I'll keep him back.
Cavanaugh turned tail and hauled ass. Carla was asleep when Jenny and Dog returned, but Jenny woke her up to tell her what had happened.
Oh, Jenny, that is so frightening. You should go see Constable Billings.
Huh, a fat lot of good that'll do. I've complained about that toad Epson stealing money from me, and the only thing he'd accomplished was to have him send Cavanaugh after me.
Well, to be honest about it, what can Billings do about Epson? Epson's with some bank in Philadelphia now. I'm sure that Mr. Billings has no jurisdiction over him. But he could certainly put Cavanaugh in jail.
For what? For wetting his pants? Because I'm sure that's what he did when Dog got after him. Besides, if Cavanaugh is the best Epson can come up with, then I don't think I have anything to worry about. You know what they say. Better the devil you can see than the one you can't see.
I suppose that's true.
And you should have seen him run.
Oh, I wish I could have seen that.
Jenny rubbed Dog behind the ears.
I'm not worried. Not as long as I have Dog to look out for me.
Once more, Theodore Epson was summoned to Joel Fontaine's office. This time, it wasn't just Fontaine, but the entire membership of the board of directors who was present for the meeting. Epson looked around nervously.
You sent for me, Mr. Fontaine?
I did.
To what purpose?
Have a seat, please.
Whereas the others were sitting in comfortable chairs around the table, the seat Fontaine offered Epson was a small, straight-backed wooden chair placed at some distance from the others.
Mr. Fontaine, may I ask what this is about?
Mr. Epson, we have received another letter from Mr. Ashley of St. Louis, and this time he included a report that a Miss Jenny...
Fontaine looked through the letter.
There doesn't appear to be a last name.
She has no last name.
No last name? Of course she has a last name. Everyone has a last name.
Many colored do not have a last name. She is a colored woman.
Really? I wasn't aware of that. According to Mr. Ashley, this is a report filed by Miss Jenny with a Constable Billings. Are you familiar with Constable Billings?
Yes, he's the chief law enforcement officer in St. Louis.
Mr. Epson, this report which Miss Jenny filed with the constable alleges that you hired someone to threaten her. According to the report, he accosted her late one night. Had it not been for the fact that the lady was accompanied by a dog, he would have done her bodily harm.
That's preposterous.
You don't believe the lady was attacked?
She may well have been attacked, for St. Louis is a wild and mostly undisciplined town. But I assure you, if that is the case, I had nothing to do with it. Why would I?
According to the report, the man who attacked us said that Mr. Epson don't want no more letters wrote about him.
Fontaine looked up from the letter.
What do you say to that?
I don't know what to say, other than to say it isn't true. I have hired no one to harm her.
Do you have any idea why she would make such a claim?
Yes, I have a very good idea. She is trying to extort money from me by making the claim that I took mortgage money from her without posting it to the books.
So it is your contention that this is part of an extortion scheme on her part?
Yes, her part and William Ashley's as well. Is there any paperwork to substantiate the claim that either of them gave me any money?
Apparently not, for no such paperwork was included in the letter.
Then I ask you, gentlemen, to consider this. We are all bankers. We deal with money every day. Our only protection against such spurious claims as these is the signed documents by which we do business. Can you imagine passing over an amount of money as large as all that without getting a signed receipt? Mr. Fontaine, as this is obviously an attempted extortion, I am the aggrieved party here. I am the one who is being falsely accused. Fortunately for me, the very basis by which we do business, the signed receipt, is, by its absence in this case, proof of my innocence.
You know, Joel, Mr. Epson has a point. In this business, we live or die by supporting documents. Seems to me contrary to everything we stand for to be accusing one of our own of a violation when there is no evidence, such as a signed receipt to substantiate this woman's claim.
Yes, I agree. Gentlemen, I am inclined to take Mr. Epson at his word. How say you?
Most of the board agreed. One of the members held up his hand.
Yes, Miller, what is it?
In principle, I agree. However, it just so happens that I'll be making a trip to St. Louis in a few weeks. Suppose while I'm there I visit with Mr. Ashley and this woman and talk to them in person.
Good idea. For now, Mr. Epson, we will take no action. I'm sure that you will be exonerated. But if Mr. Miller is going to St. Louis anyway, we may as well put this whole thing to rest once and for all. I'm sure you agree that would be the best approach.
Yes, I agree. That is best. And I assure you, I welcome a full inquiry into the matter.
I was certain you would. Now, gentlemen, let us all get back to work, shall we? After all, we do have a bank to run.
That night, in his apartment, Epson walked over to the window and looked out onto the street below. What a mess he was in. He'd not set out to steal anyone's money. When the opportunity presented itself, well, the temptation had just been too strong to resist. He recalled the sequence of events that brought him to this point. He recalled Mr. Ashley coming into the bank to pay off the mortgage on the House of Flowers. When Epson had asked Mr. Ashley from whom the money had come, Ashley had said the person wanted to remain anonymous. Epson had thought that strange, but accepted the money regardless. Then, a short while later, a strange turn of events, Miss Jenny, the owner of the House of Flowers, had come in to pay off the remaining debt on her mortgage as well. It was not until that moment that Epson realized what an opportunity had been dropped into his lap. He was due to leave on the very next day for his new job in Philadelphia. Neither Jenny nor, amazingly, Ashley before her had asked for a signed receipt. That meant he could leave St. Louis $950 richer, and no one would ever be the wiser. And that is exactly what Mr. Epson did. And although he had come through some difficulty, it looked now as if Mr. Fontaine was willing to accept his side of the story. The only fly in the ointment was Mr. Miller's trip to St. Louis. If Miller talked to Jenny, he might believe her version of the story. She was, after all, a very pretty young woman who could be very persuasive. There was only some way to keep him from talking to her. Epson stood at the window for a moment longer. Then the solution came to him. It wasn't something he would have wanted to do, and it certainly wasn't anything he could do personally. But the situation had been forced upon him. Jenny herself had forced it. Turning away from the window, Epson sat at the small writing table in his room and wrote one more letter. This one was short and to the point.
Make my problem go away.
With the letter, he included a draft for $100. If the intent of his message wasn't understood, the amount of money he was paying to carry out the operation would certainly make itself understood. He just hoped that the letter reached St. Louis before Miller did. A lone rider, tall and rawhide lean, sat his saddle easily as the horse picked its way down from the high country. Preacher was riding one horse and leading two more. The pack animals were carrying 500 plews each, beaver pelts perfectly skinned, dried, and stretched so as to be of the finest quality. The trail followed alongside a meandering brook where cool, sweet water broke white over rocks as it rushed downhill. At the end of the trail, there would be rendezvous, a gathering of mountain men and traders, trappers and fur dealers, Indians, whiskey drummers, Bible salesmen, whores, friends and strangers. Many a mountain man spent his entire winter thinking ahead for the next rendezvous, using it as an incentive to help him through the long period of isolation. Preacher wasn't one of them, though. In fact, he often changed trails to avoid these occasional meetings. For him, rendezvous was a necessary part of doing business. It was not 2 weeks of drinking, gambling, and whore. preacher smelled the rendezvous first. The aroma of coffee and cooking meat, the smell of wood and tobacco smoke, and more unpleasant odors of scores of bodies, unwashed for months, gathered in one place. The preacher rode into a clearing, and there he saw it. Men and women clad in buckskin, feathers, homespun, and store-bought suits. Bits of color, flashes of beads, silver and gold. Dozens of tents and temporary shelters had been erected, many of them little more than canvas flaps protruding from the wagons that had brought the traders, dealers, and goods here from back east.
Whoa, shit!
Looking over in surprise, preacher saw Henri Mouchette toss his rifle aside, clawing for the pistol he had stuck down in his trousers.
Oh, not again!
Preacher leapt from his horse, not away from Mouchette, as Mouchette might have suspected, but directly toward him. Mouchette was caught off guard by Preacher's unexpected reaction. Rather than pulling his pistol cleanly, he dropped it as he jerked it from his trousers. Preacher shoved Mouchette hard, and he staggered back, the tree breaking his fall. Mouchette pulled his knife and held it in front of him, palm up, the knife moving back and forth slowly, like the head of a coiled snake.
It's a rat. I'd rather gut you than shoot you anyway. Shooting kills too fast.
Mouchette nodded toward the pack horses Preacher had brought in.
By rats, they should be my blues. I pulled my traps out of the water and set your own.
Now we went through all that. My traps were there first. You pulled them out and replaced them with yours. I was only returning the favor.
Who give you title to the creek anyway?
Nobody has a title to any land up there. It's first come, first served, same as it's always been, and I was first there.
You wouldn't even have known about it if you hadn't heard me talking about it last year.
That's not true, and you know it. I've trapped that same creek for 5 winters now. You can ask anyone here.
Yeah, well, it don't matter now, because you ain't going to be trapping in it no more. I aim to split you open from your gullet to your pecker.
Mouchette lunged forward and made a swipe with his knife. The move was unexpected and quick. The preacher barely managed to dance back out of the way. Mouchette, I don't want to fight you. If you've got a dispute with me, we can take it up with the trapper's court. Trapper's court wasn't an official court. It was just a group of trappers who would hear arguments from both sides of a dispute, then suggest a settlement. Their suggestions had no power of law, only the power of public opinion. But for most mountain men, that was binding enough.
Nah, I think I'll just kill you. Then there won't be nothing to set there.
Mouchette lunged forward again, but this time Preacher was ready for him, and he easily slipped the knife thrust, then countered with a hard blow to Mouchette's ear. Mouchette jumped back, then put his hand to his ear. That gave Preacher the opening he needed, and he reached for his own knife, only to discover that it wasn't on his belt. He looked back toward his horse and saw that his knife was in a scabbard on a belt that was hanging around the saddle pommel. His rifle was in the rifle boot, and his pistol was in the saddlebag. He was barehanded against Mouchette.
Well now, ain't that something? Seems to me like you've come to a knife fight without a knife.
Mouchette crouched over and held the knife in front of him, still moving it back and forth. Suddenly, a knife whizzed by in front of Preacher and stuck in the tree beside him. Preacher had no idea who it came from, and he didn't know who to thank, but at this point, he had no time to consider such things. Preacher pulled the knife from the tree, then faced Mouchette. The easy, confident smile left Mouchette's face, but the determination didn't.
Good. I like it better this way. It'll be no fun in killing you unless you fight back, sir.
Preacher came up on the balls of his feet, crouching slightly, holding the knife firmly, but not too tight. Palm up in his right hand. Two men began moving around each other warily, now entirely circled by people who had come from all over the rendezvous, drawn to the spectacle of a fight to the death. Mouchette moved in, raised his left hand as if to shield what he was going to do, then raised his knife hand to come in behind that shield. Mouchette moved his knife hand back down swiftly, as quickly as a striking snake, and thrust it toward Preacher. Preacher felt the knife burn as it opened a cut on his side, but he managed to twist away, barely avoiding the killing thrust. He responded with a quick counter thrust. Preacher's knife went under Mouchette's ribs, slipping in cleanly, easily, and all the way to the hilt.
Uh,
And be damned, boys. I come here to kill this son of a bitch. Instead, he killed me. Now, ain't that a hell of a thing?
Preacher held up the knife he had used to kill Machete. Whose knife? When nobody spoke up, Preacher looked over toward the tree where he had gotten the knife. He grasped the point of the blade with his thumb and forefinger. He threw the knife at the tree, sticking it in the trunk in almost the same place from which he had pulled it a moment earlier. Preacher walked over to his horse, taking off his shirt and laid across the saddle while he examined the wound on his side. Fortunately, the cut wasn't very deep, and already it had stopped bleeding. He was putting his shirt back on as someone approached him. Preacher could tell by the way he was dressed that this was one of the traders from back east. The trader looked over the pack animals.
Looks like you had a good season.
Tolerable. The trader looked at the pelts more closely, folding them back to examine several of them.
More than tolerable, I'd say. These are some of the best I've seen brought in since I've been here.
Well, thanks.
You the one they call Preacher?
I am.
I work for Mr. Ashley. William Ashley. I believe you know him?
Yeah, I know him. Preacher had done business with Ashley before. In fact, he had negotiated a peace with the Indians for Ashley and his traders. In this world of few contacts and even fewer friends, William Ashley was a man that Preacher would count as a friend.
Mr. Ashley said to treat you fair.
Oh, he always has. That's his way.
Oh, and I almost forgot. He told me to give this to you.
The trader handed an envelope to Preacher. Well, thanks. As the trader continued to look through the pelts, Preacher sat on a fallen log. He opened the envelope, pulled out the letter, and began to read.
Dear Preacher, it is with great sadness that I must inform you of the death of our mutual friend, Jenny.
Oh, no.
Something wrong?
You don't know what's in this letter?
Nope. Wasn't my letter, wasn't my place to read it.
How long ago was it written?
I'm not sure. 6 weeks? 2 months, maybe? I've had it at least 6 weeks.
6 weeks?
Say, Preacher, do you mind if I take these pelts on over to my wagon so I can count and grade them?
What? Oh, no. Go ahead, I don't mind. Reluctantly, Preacher returned with the letter.
I wish I could tell you that Jenny died peacefully, but I cannot. She was murdered, Preacher, in a way so vile as to defy any attempt to describe by written words. There were two of them, but one of them got away. Nobody knows for sure who that one was, but I believe it was Ben Cavanis. I'm sure you remember him, for you had such a difficult time with him when he was part of your trapping party. The problem is, what with Jenny being a whore and all, I'm afraid there will be no justice. Preacher, I know what store you set by Miss Jenny, and I'm sorry to be the one to tell you such sad news, but I knew you would want to know. Your friend, William Ashley.
Folding the letter, Preacher got up and walked over to stick it down into his saddlebag. He glanced over toward where the fight had taken place and saw that a couple of men were already digging a grave for Machete. Moments earlier, Preacher had been locked in a life and death struggle. A struggle that he barely survived. Yet now, it seemed so remote to him that it could have happened to someone else. His thoughts were only of Jenny. He wondered where Jenny was buried, and if anyone had shown up to say a few words over her. He hoped that they had, and he knew that it would take a brave minister to risk the ire of his parishioners in order to pray over one of St. Louis's most notorious women. Preacher felt an overwhelming sense of sorrow over her loss. Then the sorrow gave way to anger. He walked over to the trader's wagon, where the trader was busy counting out and sorting Preacher's pelts.
It's amazing. All of your pelts are of the very highest quality.
How quickly can you pay me for them?
Well, if you'll take a marker against Ashley, I can pay you right away.
I'll take his marker.
Very well. I'll make one out for you.
Before you left St. Louis, did you hear about Jenny getting killed?
Oh, heavens, yes. It was all anyone talked about for a while. It's a shame about her. Such a pretty young girl. Sometimes it seems like there's no justice anymore.
Oh, there'll be justice, all right. The scales will be weighted with blood. The doctor in St. Genevieve, Missouri, daubed more wagon grease onto what was left of Ben Cavanaugh's ear.
It's a good thing you came to me when you did, since the ear was near to mortifying.
Yeah, well, it's been hurting something awful.
What did you say caused this again?
A bear. I run up against a bear and he mauled me.
Looks more like something bit this ear off rather than clawing it off.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. The bear bit it off.
You're lucky he didn't bite your whole head.
Do you have to talk so much, Doc? Just patch up the ear and stop the talking.
I was just being friendly. It's always good to be friendly with your patients. Puts them in a good frame of mind.
Yeah, well, it ain't putting me there.
Yeah, I sort of sense that.
The doctor straightened up, then looked at Cavanaugh.
That'll be $1.
$1? $1 for a handful of grease you could get off any wagon wheel?
It's not the grease you're paying for. It's the knowing what to do with the grease.
Yeah, all right.
Cavanaugh paid the doctor $1, then left the doctor's house and walked down to the river's edge to wait for the next boat to come through. When Cavanaugh had received that second letter from Epson, the one that said simply, "Make my problem go away," he knew what Epson was asking for. Epson was paying him $100 to kill Jenny. Cavanaugh had figured that he and Slater working together should be able to handle the dog with little difficulty. But that wasn't the case. The dog had attacked immediately. Even as Cavanaugh was stabbing the dog, slashing away at him, the dog was ripping out Slater's throat. Slater was dead within minutes. What started out to be an easy job turned into a nightmare. Slater was dead, and Cavanaugh had to face the dog alone. The dog turned on Cavanaugh, and Cavanaugh threw up an arm to guard his neck. Through the pain, Cavanaugh managed to raise his pistol.
Dog! No!
Dog fell to the ground. Cavanaugh had planned to have a little fun with Jenny, but it was too goddamn late for that now. Cavanaugh was bleeding so badly that he was in danger of passing out from blood loss. When he turned to the whore, the expression on her face reflected his own visage. Cavanaugh was a terrible sight to behold. He had blood all over his face, arms, and hands. The side of his head was covered with blood, too, as well as an ugly little piece of shredded flesh that was the only indication of what had once been an ear.
You bastard!
Cavanaugh made one mighty sweep with his knife, not merely cutting Jenny's jugular, but nearly decapitating her. Leaving Dog dying, and Jenny and Slater dead, Cavanaugh left the scene of the crime.